Moncrief on News Talk
with Gas Networks Ireland. Natural gas is compatible with a wide range of modern appliances. gasnetworks.ie/movetogas.
The hashtag, we have a hashtag on Twitter, it is drunk movies. That's referring back to the piece we did yesterday with the doctor who'd written a memoir of his time being a doctor, which had the famous degloving story, which we won't perhaps repeat at this point. But anyway, drunk movies is the hashtag. Excellent entries for that already, and many of them, so you can have a look on Twitter at that. Somebody wants to know, how deep is the ocean over Zealandia? I don't know. I suppose shallow enough so they could drill. Pat says, I've been reading a lot about this place over the last few months. Are they doing submarine tours? I'd love to go there. I'm 72 and I've been most places in the world. Zealandia is like a final challenge to me. That would be an interesting thing to do. I don't know if I would imagine probably for a submarine. Submarines, I imagine, are limited in their range, so I don't know if you could go that far out in a submarine. Tony says, can you ask someone a stupid question? I'd love to hear someone say that's a stupid question. Yeah, somebody did once say to me that was a stupid question. I forget who it was. But it was somebody kind of like Jeremy Paxman or somebody like that said that was a stupid question. The drill bit used in the Chilean rescue was made in Ireland. 1 billion viewers, you say, and no mention. Mad, says it. Well, we only played a short clip of that, so perhaps it was mentioned at some point during the course of reports about it. But of course, we were also talking to Mel, who was telling us that the world may or may not end. The Virgin Mary has visited him a few times. She said that asteroid going past the planet, that means something, but it was kind of vague as to what it might mean. The voice of the Virgin Mary, if you want to look at this from a supernatural view, is a demon, says Greg. The Bible says Mary died like every human and she is not a deity. Oh, and personally, I do believe in the demonic. The Bible says not to consult with mediums and spiritists. So the visions of Mary go against scripture, says Greg. OK, that's an interesting point. Though would she not be like, if she's gone up to heaven the way, you know, we're all supposed to do, can she not come back then and, you know, say how are you to Mel, tell him a few things. Wow, the Virgin Mary is telling him there will be some sort of change in the future. What a revelation. Yes, we were all shook by it. And JC in Ballinspittal, they've had a few messages of their own down there. Great to hear the spiritual vibe on the show today. What an insightful guy that guest was. I'm not sure whether it was actually that was Mel or the fella we were talking to afterwards, who was talking about Zealandia, who was an actual scientist. Anyway, it is time for two insightful guests. We are joined once again by Esther McCarthy and Tomás Clancy for Movies and Booze. Good afternoon to you both.
Good afternoon.
Hello. Are you well?
All good, yes.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah. No, sorry, that wasn't very rocking insightful.
Not very detailed there. Tomás, what wines are we going to be talking about?
We're going to be looking at the Iberian Peninsula, Spain, I think we'll call it for the moment.
Okay. are there any specific...
Yes, there are.
Wines native to the Barcelona area or
they are,
Catalan
and they
wines?
Are Catalan wines, and we have one here today. And not only that, but it's a real signifier of Catalonian independence and Catalan sort of identity. It's called a Clos d'Estima, and the way in which the blend has been made is kind of we could interpret it in a nationalistic way. Because they're not calling the wine a Tempranillo, they're calling it Oul de Lèbre, which I'm sure I'm pronouncing really bad. I'm sure it's Yerbre, but that's the Catalan name for Tempranillo.
Oh,
so this is very much the Gaeltacht kind of idea here. You know, this is we've got two potential languages being used here.
You can read the emails of complaint there now. You can. Which are Westbrook jokes about Gaeltacht. Okay, so they have their own, and would they tend to have their own names for almost, other grapes as well?
They do. They have their own names for almost everything, and this particular wine comes from the mountains behind Barcelona, which includes Montserrat, which is an iconic mythic thing within Catalan hagiography and sort of identity. It's a big part of it. So this is it's a mystical sort of place as well. And he's also got a Syrah. And this is even more controversial because the thing about Catalonia and the Catalan people is that they've been separated, not only obviously brought into Spain as Catalonia, but a large, a reasonable sized chunk of the Catalan homeland is contained within Ruisson, which is just north of the border
in France,
in the Languedoc. So the Languedoc, the full name of the Languedoc is Languedoc-Ruisson. And that second bit, that Ruisson bit, is the south bit there. And that's around Perpignan and all these places there. They speak Catalan. They consider themselves, they've got Van de Peter Catalan, they've got all kinds of Catalan homage and so forth. So if this goes, you know, if that goes that particular way, there'd be, eventually, there would be a significant drive to unify, I would imagine, the whole of the Catalan people.
And you said this producer also makes a Syrah, but calls it a Syrah.
Exactly. So he's calling it a Syrah, which is really, again, pointing to the fact that this is coming, that's the French sort of element of it. So he's got a Syrah, the French element of it, and the Ulli de Rebre, which is the Tempranillo pronounced from Catalonia. So this is all, it's all ready to boil over.
Oh, wow.
And
okay.
We got that, and then a strong Spanish going nowhere Rioja.
Right. Going nowhere. Can you ask the wine expert where I could get Gran Lomo Malbec? It was in Dunn's about 6 months ago for a while. I haven't found it anywhere since.
Yeah, I think it was a Dunn's Stores exclusive. They come round. The thing you've got to remember about wine, the difference between wine and baked beans is they can make baked beans 365 days a year.
Yeah.
They harvest wine once a year and then they bring it up and sell it to us. So just, you have to pause there, look for the other seasonal wines that are in, and that will come around as night follows day,
right?
In a few months' time.
Are there times of the year when different sorts of wines become available?
Absolutely. So the early wines, for instance, right now they're just finishing fermenting a lot of wines. So in a few weeks' time, Beaujolais will be ready, the earliest of them. Rosés are often drained off after they begin sort of looking at how they're going to bottle up. So that tends to be in sort of May, June. So they're ready for June. So they do completely depend. They are very dependent on time. But you can release wines at any stage you want. Once you've got that, you know, once you've been in business for a couple of years, you've then got a cellar full of them and you release them at appropriate times. But people do. So we drink white and rosé. We really do switch to white and rosé wines during the summer in a big way. And we're back coming into the kind of breezy sort of weather that just says, you know, big hearty Shiraz, nice big Malbec, warming winter food. And we match it to the food. So if you've got a big stew, you know, a little Riesling is not going to be the obvious choice.
But it's kind of weirdly warm out there today.
It's strange today. Yeah, it's very strange.
Well, the world's going to end. That's probably the reason why.
That thing in the Azores will fall off.
That's what's going on. I was in Frascati this summer and visited a small vineyard. The wine they make there is called Descantis. S-C-A-N-T-I-S. It's organic. Do you know anywhere in Ireland that sells this?
No, I don't think I do. I was there myself last year and I fell in love with Frascati. It's just such a beautiful, it's close to Rome. Very, very ancient looking properties. We don't bring it in here. We used to bring in Frascati about 10, 15 years ago, but it's comparatively priced. It's quite expensive for a light white wine, and we've really gone sort of Chilean and Australian for our light white wines now, unfortunately.
Yeah, okay. The hashtag on Twitter is Drunk Movies, inspired by an item we did yesterday. If your big idea is Schindler's Pissed, I wouldn't bother you because everybody's done that one already. Absinthe of Malice is one particularly clever one I just saw. Anita says, Esther, About Time was on the movie the other night. I can't decide if this movie is really annoying or brilliant. I don't think this is Donald's finest movie, nor is it Bill Nighy's. Am I missing something obvious about this movie? All of Richard Curtis's movies have the same treatment, making them all so samey.
I was afraid to say all that stuff out loud for about a year because everyone loved About Time so much. And actually, sometimes you get to see something really, really early because maybe a studio wants to bring in a certain, you know, type of reviewer to road test maybe, or get a feel for something they were very excited about and did very well, actually, to be fair. And it just left me cold. And I think they were going, they thought I'd be like coming out in tears or something. But I wasn't. I was just like, yeah.
Well, you see, you're hard.
And I know.
That's it, you're hard.
I mean, too many
bitter years in this game.
And it has. And I'm a crier at cinema, though. It's easy to make me cry. But I just, yeah, it was. It is the Richard Curtisness of it, I think. You
either like Richard Curtis movies or you don't, really.
I just feel, and there's a beautiful twist with the Bill Nighy story towards the end of About Time that's very moving. You can't deny it. Mm. But what came before was just so, I just feel like I'm watching a variation of a Richard Curtis type. I never feel like I'm watching a real character a lot on these films.
There is a kind of almost an idealised thing there. Everybody lives in lovely houses. And even in London, they have a fabulous flat. And everybody
Tim and stuff like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, and there's a certain kind of sort of wit that they have, which is not a million miles away from sort of the jokes that you'd see in what's her name?
Woody Allen films?
No. She's the one with the face like a slapped arse who I get round to it now. No, Bridget Jones. Yeah, it's like Bridget Jones movies. Yeah.
Yeah. What was your point on that?
There's a similar sort of wit level there, a sort of a type of joke that they
Well, I loved the first Bridget Jones film, I have to say, and I was a fan of the books as well, unashamedly. But I think the Richard Curtis stuff in particular, I just think they're always called Tim. They're always from nice, but a bit dim.
Bad things happen, but they're not that bad.
Yeah, not that bad. They also have a wacky friend who says inappropriate things at dinner parties. It's like you feel like you're ticking off boxes when you're watching a Richard Curtis film.
Yeah, he does. Yeah, there's always a crazy sister stroke best friend.
Yes, usually with pink hair or something.
Yeah, and they usually have pink hair or short hair. Yeah. There's a lot of crazy short-haired women in Richard Curtis films. Mm.
But I have to say that the little twist that comes towards the end of About Time is very touching, to be fair. And I love Bill Nighy. You can have him in anything, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
He's done a lot of Richard Curtis films.
Yeah. So I didn't think... I thought it was quite sweet, but that's only because I live in a house with someone who adores that film.
I know.
I can't talk. Esther McCarthy and Tomás Clancy are with us once again. Actually, we did play a clip of Emma Thompson at the start of the show, and not unconnected to some Richard Curtis films. Someone says, she's so balchy, I love her. Weinstein is no match for a woman like her. Delighted she made him quake in his boots. And we did play a clip from the interview she gave last night where she thought that Weinstein
was awesome.
She was, yeah. But you would not mess with her. No, she'd breakfast.
I've had the pleasure of interviewing her, and she's actually a very nice woman.
Oh, I'm sure she is. Yeah, yeah. She wouldn't want to get in the wrong side of her.
Yeah, she's kind of, there's a chumminess about her though when you're talking to her. That's actually quite endearing. It was for Nanny McPhee, which she had written and produced, so she was invested in the film, I guess.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed it now, I must say. Yeah.
Robin Tallis says, just going back to Richard Curtis films, Richard Curtis characters are bookish, foppish. They work part-time in a bookshop or volunteer at a women's refuge, but live in Notting Hill in a Victorian house that's worth 2 million. Not at all cliché, says Rob. No, indeed not. Watched Wind River the other night. Best film this year, hands down, says Gav.
Super film. I'm delighted to hear. We're getting so many texts from people who've gone to see it. I thought it was great. It's great to see Jeremy Renner not doing Marvel stuff and just doing a proper, decent character. It's a great police procedural. And I think it might be still in a few cinemas if you haven't caught it yet.
We were yakking so much before the break, we didn't even say what films we're going to talk about today. So you better run us through that.
Yes, we'll be talking about The Snowman and Michael Fassbender's worrying career wobble that's going on at the moment.
He's had
a few duds in the last few years, now a few big duds. So we'll be talking about that. This is like based on Joe Nesbo's massively best-selling novel, of course, and is looks at the troubled detective Harry Hull, who is based in Norway and is this kind of haunted character, but very good at solving crimes. Has a real feel of let's kickstart a franchise here and remake all these Joe Nesbo books in English,
right?
But based on what we see here, I think it could be dead in the water, actually. It's really not good at all. But I can see, to be fair, why Fassbender might have been attracted to the idea of it.
Right.
Really good people on board as well. Like, they've got a Hans Christian Thomas Alfredson, as for short. and he made a couple of films. He made the Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy adaptation a few years ago, which everyone loved so much. But he made a vampire thriller called Let the Right One In. It was Swedish. It was remade in English, but the original was an absolutely terrific vampire thriller that managed to kind of go beyond the genre and be really properly spooky and make you feel it could possibly happen. You know, so he's very, very good at that kind of Scandi noir thing. And there's a good cast on board here as well. Fassbender, Rebecca Ferguson, Charlotte Gainsbourg. So it's we'll talk about how sometimes you can have all the stars aligned, but the movie can turn out less than the sum of its parts. You know? Indeed.
And the other movie is a doc. In fact, there's couple of documentaries you're going to talk about.
That's a great week for Irish docs. Actually, it's a great year for Irish docs. We've had a lot of good ones this year. But we're going to talk about It's Not Yet Dark, which is just uplifting but heartbreaking at the same time. It's the story of Simon Fitzmaurice, who's a filmmaker based down in Greystones. Mm-hmm. And in his early 30s, married to Ruth, who actually brought out a novel. A memoir recently. Mm. And they have 5 young kids. And in his early 30s, he was diagnosed with motor neuron disease. Not only an awful personal affliction, but a kind of a potential quenching of a really good voice in Irish cinema, actually. Mm. And has since gone on to, despite having this disease, has gone on to make a film 2 years ago called My Name is Emily, using eye gaze technology to direct his cast and crew, which was actually
Crikey.
Amazing and a world first. You know, he by that stage, he was unable to speak. And it was a world first that he was able to do that. And you know what? It was a decent film as well. It was very sweet, with Evanna Lynch in the lead role. And this is a documentary based on his book of the same name about how he just his desire to embrace life as much as he can despite his illness.
Okay. Yeah. And the other documentary you're going to mention has got the intriguing title of Kevin Roach, the Quiet Architect.
This was great, I have to say. It tells the story. You know, there's these kind of amazing Irish people who maybe have lived abroad for years that we don't know enough about and we don't celebrate enough. I'd put Kevin Roach kind of well into that category because he's an architect who's done some of the most loved buildings in the world, like the Ford Foundation in New York. And he's been involved in the designing the galleries for the Metropolitan Museum in New York for like 40 years now. Sprightly 95. I had the pleasure of talking to him last week. He's no intention of retiring. He still works.
Good for him.
And he is a man, you know, maybe ages freedom up to not be short of an opinion. And it's a very colourful and entertaining documentary, I have to say.
Okay, well, that's great. The hashtag is drunk movies, a pack of crisps now. and someone's texting to say Harry Hole is actually pronounced holy. So it's Harry Holy. No. That's even worse. Would you prefer your surname to be Hole or Holy?
I prefer neither, actually.
Mick says, just back from the Camino to Santiago, the local white Albarino is fantastic and now available in Ireland, although I preferred it at €1 a glass as opposed to 6. Just saying. Says Mick. Well, indeed. Castello de Diablo, Devil's Collection, is very tasty wine, but I find it hard to get regularly, Dex says. Any ideas?
It's strange to not get regularly, I'll tell you that. It's from Conchituro, which is the largest Chilean producer, you know, in Chile, and one of the top 10 wineries on this planet. So you can find it in Tesco, Super Value, Dunnes. You know, it is in every single one of the supermarkets. Maybe your own local one goes in and out of stock. I would say have a little look around and you will be rewarded relatively quickly.
Right. And our obscure question of the day comes from Kent, who says, I drank a wonderful wine with a friend one night. Just can't remember the name. It was an Australian Pinot Noir and had a purple coloured label and had a sketch of a man with a wide brimmed hat. Can you please ask your wine expert if you could help me remember the name?
Yes.
You're kidding. Go and ask your friend.
It's so annoying. It's on the tip of my tongue. But I do know it. They make a rosé and they make this Pinot Noir.
It'll come back to you.
And it'll come back to me in 5 seconds.
Yeah. Oh, that's extraordinary. Well done,
Tomás.
Right, because that's like, you know, I had wine with a friend and can you remember what socks I was wearing
that
day?
Well, I mean,
day,
a lot of people come up and say, I had a red wine, it was lovely. Do you know what it was?
Yes.
So that's a little bit harder. This one is a little bit easier.
This might be similar. Mike says, can you ask Tomás what he thinks of Chateau Neuf de Pape? Stayed in Chateau Fines Roche in 1999 on our honeymoon and the white was amazing. I sent loads of white and red home for us on our return, but needless to say, it didn't last long.
Excellent.
Is there a white version of Chateau Neuf?
There is, and it's in fact a stunning wine. First of all, we love Chateau Neuf de Pape.
Yeah.
It's one of, you know, it's one of the great classic regions. The thing I love about it even more than that is that you in France, when you go into shops, they often spell it CH9. And I just thought, that's so cool.
Yeah.
But Chateauneuf is made from, often made from Roussanne, the white. And if you leave it for about 10 or 12 or 15 years of age, it gets this kind of, it's like just freshly roasted coffee grounds when you open it out. Mm. And you get this lovely sort of coffee ground sort of note off it. And then it's a very rich and kind of a lush, creamy white wine. It's a very, very interesting white wine. It's a rarity, a relative rarity, because obviously they spend a great deal of time on the 13 varietal mélange that is the red wine of Chateauneuf du Pape itself, one of the most complex that we have that's out there. We love it, and the reason we love it is because 600 years ago the popes were actually living there, and they invested a great deal of money and energy and time in the breakaway papacy.
Right, but that was the days there were two popes.
There were two popes. Well, yeah. There was one pope. See, it began by the papacy moving there en masse,
yes,
from the Vatican, and they when they got there, they put the whole of Catholic money into making this a paradise. So they needed viticultural paradise as well.
Yeah, of course.
The papacy ran on a good deal of good red wine at the time. Then, when they decided to go back to Rome, some of them stayed behind, and that's when we had the split at that point in time.
But there's no equivalent in Italy then?
Of
Chateauneuf.
Of Chateauneuf. No, although Frascati would get the vote, because Castel, the summer palace of the Pope is actually in the middle of the Frascati region. So there is a...
Handy. So he can just put his arm out the window.
Straight out, yeah. down the mountain.
Grab a bottle. Can you recommend a good champagne stroke bubbles for guests at a party tonight? Don't know what to get, says Simon, who's in Sutton. That leaves it fairly open, really.
That's very open. It's all dependent on price. The reality is Prosecco is the cheapest thing that you'll get out there. But if you want to go interesting, why not look at Cremant de Alsace, which is made from Riesling and Pinot Blanc. And you'll get them from Le Caveau, and there's a few of them around in all the good independent wine shops as well. And then if you want to go very solidly champagne, but without spending champagne money, go for Cava. Because it's bottle aged, it's individually bottle fermented, just as they do in champagne, but you're looking at much, much cheaper.
The hashtag, by the way, is Drunk Movies, Scuttered Island, Uncle Buckled, and Jägermeister and Commander. And it's the top trend in Ireland already, I'm pleased to say. Well done, everybody. I'm serving quail this weekend. Any thoughts on the wine?
This is a question that is regularly asked
is
at home.
Yeah.
No. Quail, again, quail, it's not quite as gamey as a lot of other sort of birds. So if you really are having quail, this is where actually the Pinot Noir comes into its own. I would go red, I wouldn't go white, and I'd go a light Pinot Noir, a Volnay, or something from the Côte de Beaune. So south of Burgundy goes well with quail. It has great acidity, will cut through any kind of gamey sort of grease that's in there.
Mm. Somebody's just texted in, could the name of that wine be Innocent Bystander?
Yes, it could. I got the word by, but that's as far as I got. I said, no, we've got to get further than that. It's Innocent Bystander. They make a fantastic rosé in a quarter bottle with a crown cap. That's the kind that you close a beer with.
Yes.
Like that. And it's really lovely. And in Australia, you see a lot of people drinking that with straws. And it's very cool and casual.
That was from Jerry in Galway. Well done, Jerry.
Well done.
Right, let's move on to our first wine of the day.
Our first wine of the day is the Clos d'Estima Syrah Oul de Lebre from Penedès in Catalonia. This is 2014. The great thing about Spanish wine, or Catalan wine, as we're looking at here first, is that they walk the walk and they talk the talk. They tend not to release the wine until it's just about ready. So you'll not see a lot of Spanish wine that's released, 2016. They will always wait 2 or 3 years because that's the style they like. They like it to have a bit of age upon it. Mm. And so when you put your nose into this, you get the kind of, there's a little coffee sort of note, a little sort of mocha note, and then you get a kind of a richer wine. They always have a lot of good acidity in these wines. And they get acidity here despite the heat because a lot of the great Spanish wine regions have gone upwards, and you'll see that all the time. So across Spain, it's hot. It is hot and dry.
Yeah.
But what you do, if you want to get coolness and you want to get a bit of water, you go up the side of mountains. So Ribera del Duero is on the high Ribeiro Plain. Rioja is in the high foothills of the Pyrenees. The wines of the Catalan region are all in the Penedès Mountains behind Montserrat, behind Barcelona, in about an hour's drive inland. And so what they've done is every sort of foot you go up, or every 100 feet that you go up, you're dropping about a degree in temperature. So if you can get up a few hundred feet, you can bring it back to the kind of temperatures that we'll get good. You won't get a big soupy, glutinous wine. You'll get a well-balanced wine. And that's what they've done here. The winemaker here is a man called Juan Solar. I presume I'm dreadfully pronouncing that, and I apologize. He is a terrifically interesting man, a young man with unbelievably good hair. I mean, just the best hair I've seen for a very long time. I mean, flowing blonde locks in kind of curls, tipping on his collar. And a lot of people just sort of, he has disciples, you know, that's the kind of winemaker he is. And they tend to talk about, you know, what he's doing and what he isn't doing. And then you do meet him, and then you see that he has charisma. He does. Yeah. He has definite charisma. So that he used to make wine for some of the larger concerns in the Catalan region, but then he decided to go out on his own and go and pick these very interesting mystical sites. And these sites, what's mystical and interesting about them is that these places are full, the vineyards where these are full of strange little huts and houses and lost villages and lost castles. And they used to think, they didn't know what these were. We now know that some of them, not all of them, some of them are Roman, but some of them are even further back to Greek and Phoenicians. And the Greeks and the Phoenicians came over to this kind of crescent coming down from Marseille right the way down to Barcelona. They saw that as sort of the end, the corner end of the world.
Yes.
And they hit into it, and they explored all of that. So all over there are amphora and little sort of lost temples and strange little streams. And of course, they were obsessed with streams and brooks and particularly with sources and spas. And so this place is filled. These mountains are filled with little caves with little sources and spring waters and hot waters and cool and mineral waters. And so that's where all of these places have little, you could, and people have come across exploring, you know, that 2,000, 2,500 year old statue hidden behind, you know, in masses, you know, centuries of cluster.
So people would come there for specific reasons.
Yes. They'd come there because it was seen as a source.
Yeah.
And they, obviously mountains where gods live and so forth up high and in these strange places. And so he's gone back up there, and they've done this the same again in the northern part of Catalonia, up near the border. They've gone up into the hills for all of these things. Down on the flat plains is where you'll see the wines that are really being used for say cava and say everyday white drinking wine. But all of the good red wine tends to be up here in the higher hills. And that mysticism, and there really is a ridiculous amount of mysticism. It's all a little bit sort of, you know, straw man kind of affair. You just feel some of these villages are very, very strange indeed.
Okay.
And you just, when you go over the border, when they talk about the people who speak with the Occitan, you know, language in the Languedoc, these are strange people, separate as well, with mysteries, you know, sort of backgrounds. And maybe this is where Jesus allegedly also lived out his days with Joseph Arimathea and Mary before ascending uncorrupted into heaven. And so this is all going on. The wine doesn't reflect any of that, thankfully. The wine, but it's where they've chosen to be, and they feel of the soil. And this is where we have this strange little crossover between terroir and nationalism. Because terroir is all about saying that what we've planted here produces something completely different to what you've planted there.
Mm.
And so what we've got here in our two wines today is, the second one is from Faustino, and is a Tempranillo planted in Rioja, Heartland, Spain. This is a Tempranillo planted in Catalonia, Heartland, Catalonia. And therefore, we're saying it's completely different. You know, it's created by its own soil. It's created by the people, the temperature, the climate. And so this idea of terroir is about individuation, which is, you know, really where nationalism comes from. There's something special about us.
Our
here
soil.
In this,
like, yeah, literally.
And us and the people and the land. Now, I love this wine. It's a really, really gorgeous wine. And I, you know, really think it's muscular and a little bit of spice. There's some nice cool tones of chocolate and a little daub of melted cocoa. And it's a very, very nice wine. It's very reasonably priced. You can get it in Terroirs of Donnybrook. Now, strange enough, another Terroirs. Mm-hmm. Terroirs of Donnybrook. And it's around about $16.95. They often have it down, and I think it is down to $13.95 on sale. So it's not it's not an expensive wine. It's a well-priced, very interesting wine from a particular region. Now, it's one of these things that I'm absolutely convinced in terroir-driven wines. You can see the difference in it.
Mm.
I'm less convinced in the kind of the nationalistic spillover from
that. It's dramatically different from anything 20 miles to the south.
Exactly, because I think the whole point is that human beings are not as intimately linked to the soil as the vines are. The vines are going nowhere,
yeah.
And they're buried down 900 feet into it. Intellectually, spiritually, and physically, we move and interchange, intermarry, intermingle in a very different way. However, it is a cri de coeur for a Catalonian experience, and that if you want to have a look at it, Claude Estima is something you might try this
Yeah,
weekend.
It's very nice, I must say.
I'm kind of in love with the label, I have to say.
It's a nice
like
label,
like a Liberty
too.
Print yeah. or something, doesn't it?
Yes, it's a very attractive label. It is, again, the flowers from around it, very full of beautiful flowers. It's the only place I've ever walked where you come to a meadow of flowers. It feels alpine.
Ah,
beautiful.
That's beautiful. The hashtag is drunk movies. Mum threw up in the cuckoo's nest. And the long piss goodnight.
Layla Olsen and Arvis Stope were having an affair, and that's the last thing my father was investigating before he got killed.
You broke into Vetlesen's house because you were afraid I'd find out this was personal and take you off the case.
Vetlesen was his pimp. And they were both in Bergen when the murder started.
I know how much you want this, but you can't force the pieces to fit.
Do you actually think he killed them?
I don't know. I don't think either of us do for sure.
Maybe this will bring your balls back.
There you go. That's Michael Fassbender there as Harry Hole or Harry Holy, whatever his name is, in The Snowman there. Right, so
we'll call him Harry from now on.
Yeah. So presumably he's a cop. Is this set in Denmark or Sweden?
Oslo, yeah. Yeah. And it looks lovely. And it's all snowy and Scandi bleak and very atmospheric. So that's the one plus it has.
Okay.
Maybe the only plus, to be honest. So he is Harry. You know when sometimes in a movie over-eggs something, it's like, okay, we know he's a chain-smoking heavy drinker. You don't have to have him light yet another cigarette and wake up on a park bench. So there's a lot of that kind of laying foundation stuff early on. And he is, what can I tell you? He's got a lot going on in his own life. So he's not officially on this case, but he ends up informally on it because he is trying to maintain good relations with his ex-wife, who's played by Charlotte Gainsbourg. You're supposed to believe he forms this connection, but there was very little on-screen charisma between them, I have to say, despite the fact that they're both really good actors. But he's supposed to form this connection with a police department newcomer by the name of Catherine Bratt, who's played by the very, very good Rebecca Ferguson, has impressed me in a good few movies over the last couple of years. Relative newcomer, but she's just interesting, you know, she's just very compelling to watch. And she's this cop who's starts to notice a few connections between domestic cases of missing women in and around the city. Not least because the killer seems to have a calling card, which is that he builds a menacing looking snowman around the properties of the women who go missing. So you think they'd have tweaked it a bit earlier.
Yeah, yeah,
but
think
anyway,
so. Yeah.
Now, these snowmen, they're not nice. Like if the clown in It freaked you out, wait till you see these fellas.
Okay.
You know, you won't be singing Happy Holidays. And there's a series of women go missing, and his methods of killing the women, as it turns out, turn out to be very gruesome. But that emerges much later in the film. So I kind of liked where it threatened to go, but unfortunately it just kind of fell apart then. What I liked about it was there was a kind of a moral ambiguity to the whole thing, because you got the sense that the killer was killing these women because he didn't believe in decisions they had made in their lives. Okay, so that he was actually kind of passing judgment on them.
Well, he was killing them. There's no more harsh judgment than that.
And so there was that going on. Oh, this could go somewhere interesting, you know, that it's kind of a...
Very judgmental murderer.
Very judgmental murderer. How dare you? I'm going to lynch you now. But then it just kind of falls apart because you get a load of red herrings, like an annoying amount of red herrings, a load of loose plot strands that are not tied up in any meaningful kind of or interesting kind of way. And then you've kind of some mad casting in there as well. So, like, you've got J.K. Simmons, who's playing kind of this powerful businessman, and you've got Val Kilmer, who in a story that emerges as in flashback is this kind of crazy detective type. And you've got this kind of dubious local doctor who, like, all he has to do is, you know, pull up his collar and start laughing maniacally, and it couldn't be a more over-the-top performance. So you're kind of, these are all hinted as potentially characters involved. But after an hour and a half, Sean, I didn't care, really. It just doesn't propel the story along in any meaningful kind of way. I think Fassbender he's a very charming actor. He can do that kind of rakish smile and the whole screen lights up. But I felt like he was coasting on that here a little. And I didn't, now to be fair to him, it's not on the script. He wasn't given much to work with. But I felt like he didn't put any flesh on the bones of this character at all. And if the whole thing has been driven by this troubled detective, well, you want to know about him, you want to care about him, you want to invest in him for all
these
flaws.
Aren't all detectives nowadays troubled? Aren't they all drunks? You really need to have a sober one.
Just have
the
really
pioneer detective.
High-functioning detective. Wouldn't that be great? So it's amazing, really, how badly this falls apart, because the pedigree of the people involved, as I say, the director of Let the Right One In and Tinker Tailor, you've got Peter Strogan, who's writing, co-writing the script, who wrote Frank, like probably my favourite Lenny Abrahamson film,
okay.
With John Ronson a few years ago, and also wrote Tinker Tailor. And then you've got this like big name cast, so there was a lot of expectation for this one, but it just doesn't. It really falls apart pretty badly, actually. And if they're kickstarting its series, they need to go back to the drawing board with this one, I think.
A couple of observations on that film that people have texted in. JD says, killers leave footprints in snow. How hard can it be to track him down? Duh!
There is one scene where they say, I know he's supposed to be a gifted detective and stuff, but even I'd probably twigged that you follow the footprints in the snow, you know.
So Anto wants to know, how come everybody in the trailer has an English accent when it's set in Norway?
Yeah, well, there's an argument for and against that, I suppose, with films set in other cities. Yeah, they all have a slightly theatrical accent. But I think if you put on a version of an accent and the people aren't from that country and they're speaking English, it can sound a little bit
You know? Say, does Val Kilmer put on an English accent, Dora?
Yeah, well, he tries, yeah.
Yeah. Crikey. So now in Hollywood, English just means any foreigner.
Yeah.
Pretty much. Yeah.
It's just, it's almost fascinating to see how you can have so much talent and a big budget attached to a project and it can still go wrong, you know?
Has Esther seen the movie Breathe yet? Andrew Garfield always looks so frail and ill anyway, so this role looks like it would suit him.
I have seen Breathe, actually. It's quite good. It's a little bit Oscar baity, I would say.
Okay.
Which I'm a bit allergic to, but he's very good in it. It's based on this real life character whose name escapes me, but this man who had his whole life in front of him.
And it's set in the 1920s or something.
Yeah, he contracted polio. And ended up on this iron lung, really, for the rest of his life. And it's kind of how, with the help of people who love him and care about him, that he kind of manages to invest in his life, I suppose.
Davey says, can you ask your movie expert what Geostorm is like and is it worth watching?
I can't because we haven't seen it yet. It's out next week.
There's trailers for it though.
Yeah. It's
that's usually a bad sign if they haven't showed it to you yet.
Well, I don't know whether they are or not, to be fair, but I haven't gotten any notification of a screening yet, and it's out next Friday. So.
Keith and Poppentry observes that Greystones is just the sort of place where everybody pretends they're in a Richard Curtis film. I'm not familiar enough with Greystones to know that or not. If you're from Greystones, maybe you can text in and confirm or deny that one. I went to see Blade Runner 2049. So did you, Tomás?
I loved it.
Yeah, me
good.
Too.
You really enjoyed it, yeah?
Yeah.
Because it's getting mixed response and it did really
really badly at the box office, which was astounding.
Only in the US. Ah, it performed very well in Ireland and the UK and overseas. So it, I think, yeah. And interestingly, though, the first one struggled at the box office as well.
As well,
so
yeah. Because
we'll
it's a bit too pointy-headed for a sci-fi
exactly.
movie.
It is a bit, you know, it's not immediate. And you think having Gosling and a starry cast on board would draw people in, but it didn't, as it turns out. But the problem is not necessarily what it made at the box office, it's what it cost.
Yeah.
Because it was a really, you know, as you can see, it looks absolutely stunning up on screen, but it cost like north of 150 million to make. So it's a long road back to make that money.
They must
back
have
then.
Just made it entirely in front of a blue screen.
No, it's nearly all stages. It's yeah. They built huge sets.
Oh my God.
And apparently they had the drawers. If you open the drawers, all the stuff's in the drawers to make it feel more real. So it's
most
all.
Most filmmakers
there.
Will only do blue screen when they've no other options, really.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So there could be a lot of blue screen in it, but you'll probably find there's a lot of. Yeah, brilliantly built sets there as well. I'm glad you liked it.
Yeah, no, I because I think there was maybe two jokes in it. There were reasonably, I can't remember what they were now, but you'd almost kind of hope that would be just to leaven the mood slightly. But I did smile to myself where, you know, he's in his flying car and it's raining and he turns on the windscreen wipers. And I thought, it's, you know, you got a flying cars, but you don't have an alternative to rubbish windscreen wipers yet. And you can make humans, but you can't do this. I thought it was... You know, the kind of the original Blade Runner that people read a lot into it, and this Blade Runner almost like explored those themes a bit more.
Exactly. I mean, the first one was all, you know, it was all tensed up. But unfortunately, I was one of the people who loved the voiceover.
You like that version.
See, I love the Dashiell Hammett kind of like, you know, sort of, you know, it was a dark day here. Yeah. You know, I liked that, you see.
I don't think that would work, though, anymore. I think that's of its time, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm not sure that...
But that was, I think, because he didn't want that voiceover. He was forced to take that voiceover.
That's right. They were channeling a kind of a...
Yeah.
They didn't do it in the first place, and that's why when they came back, they stripped it out. But it was to make it more obvious that it was a homage to sort of film noir, you know, and detective films. But I really liked it. I wanted it to be 3.5 hours. I wanted one more scene. You know, I wanted an explanation for the wall. Was that rising tide and so forth? There was a few things I still want.
I wanted more Ryan Gosling in that aviator jacket. My God,
I wouldn't be surprised if there isn't another one.
Well, let's see now if they make their costs, or let's see what, you know, the emerging big cinema markets in places like Asia. Of it. I think that'll kind of tell the story there.
53106 is our text number, and someone did text in claiming that people who live in Greystones think they live in a Richard Curtis film. Lisa Marie, who's in Greystones, says, "I'm just a girl standing in front of 17 coffee shops and a shop selling €200 jeans. I'm eating an organic apple in my vegan Speedos." So you can draw from that what you will. Let's move on to our second wine today, Tomás.
Our second wine today is from what used to be part of Greater Spain and is now part of Lesser Spain going forward.
Okay.
So this is from Rioja. Rioja, the Rioja region is up in the far north of Spain, but on the left-hand side, on the west side of the Pyrenees, and so just south of San Sebastian and Santander, so up at that coast. It's always been a remote high area, and it has three sort of different sections to it: a lower, middle, and a very, very high section. The Bas Rioja is incredibly hot. Really, really hot, and is a desert-like area north of Zaragoza. And this is where
A lot of the Clint Eastwood, Sergio Leone films
were actually
filmed. And you can actually go to the town where they did the A Fistful of Dollars and march around doing whistling music and imitating all of these things.
Yeah.
Exactly. Very hard not to do that as you go there. But anyway, if you press on beyond that, you'll see those vines. And then going further and further and further up the mountains, you come to the high Rioja sort of area. And this is where they've got these towns where they call them stations and outposts. So they are bodegas, but they're also, they have this idea of being remote locations, like in the Douro, where they're quintas that are self-supporting because they're a little village, a little fortified village of their own. And kind of re-emphasizing that in the 1970s and 80s were big places like La Rioja Alta, which is one of the biggest and oldest bodegas there, which practically fortified itself because there were so many attacks on these bodegas at that time by the separatist movements from the Basque region. So the Basque region, which is the flip side to the Catalonian sort of independence, but on the left-hand side of the Pyrenees, they saw these as symbols of the sort of imperious and imperial Spanish state located right up in the foothills of their mountains. And they didn't exist more than 200 years ago. This was a creation of, Rioja is really a creation of the phylloxera era in the middle of the 19th century. Phylloxera was a disease, a louse that came from America and wiped out every single vineyard in Europe. And so Bordeaux houses were looking to see what they would do, and they travelled south to look for a place where they could find that the louse hadn't got to, and they went high. And so they built train stations up to these places that the trains went down to the big city, the big ports onto the Atlantic. And this became where people made Rioja, made the Rioja wines, which substituted for Bordeaux for between about the 1860s and about 1920 when they got back on their stable level again. This is Faustino, and Faustino was the first of these huge bodegas to actually do this in a very big way. And in Ireland in the 1980s, this meant Spanish wine. Faustino meant Spanish wine.
Yeah.
And Faustino, this is the Faustino 7. It's their kind of regular. It's the regional variation one of it. It's around about 13 or 14 euros. It's a really opulent, generous wine, but with a bit of age. So this is the 2014. So you've still got a bit of age. And it feels that now. Silky smooth, delicious, old-fashioned in a way, but with a new twist of not having too much cedar in it.
Yeah,
but a great wine,
and it's a hugely popular wine.
Hugely popular wine
in this country. Now, you were thinking about that Australian Shiraz, woman on a bike on the label,
right? Well, I thought it was a rally.
Yeah,
I was trying to think of the type of bike it was. Hill of Content
is that? That's the name of the wine. Well done, Tomás. Anything you want to ask him, he knows the answer off the top of his head. I'm thinking of picking Douro Crasto Tinta Barra. Oh, mother of God. I'm not going to read that out because it's just too difficult. I once drank a chunky green liquid with an aftertaste of oak and llamas and sunglasses. It came in a bottle that was really an urn with a picture of a lizard on horseback and it waving a sword. Does Tomás know the name of it? Well, that's too easy. So why would you bother?
Too specific. Too easy.
I think that the wine Chat on Oof or Cat on Egg is clever. No idea what it's like. Any thoughts? Pat wants to know.
There's about three of these kind of humorous ones. There, a lot of them are South. They're South African, and they've got goats do roam for instead of coats a coat do roam, and it's very, very, very good stuff from the Fairview Winery. Worth a look.
Yeah, Chris from Canvara says Blade Runner 1 only film I ever fell asleep at. That's called narcolepsy, Chris. You should really get that checked out. It's a very serious condition. We'll move on to our second movies. Two documentaries. First one, it's Not Dark Yet. We do have a clip of that one. Here it is.
When you're told you will die within a certain period, time slows down. Life becomes dominated by the last time. Is this the last time I will read a book to one of my boys? If not the last, how many more? I'm running after Jack and I'm thinking, is this the last time I'll be running? So I speed up.
Dada.
I'm running with a limp, and so running full tilt becomes a series of long hops and strides. But I'm running.
There you go. That's a clip from It's Not Yet Dark. Obviously, there was Colin Farrell there narrating.
Yeah. And giving voice to Simon Fitzmaurice, who wrote this, but and wrote a memoir in which it's based. But by the time it got into production, unfortunately, Simon was no longer able to speak. And he does have an eye gaze technology, which involves him being able to use a computer program to communicate. But I think Colin had met him at through film circles, and they'd become quite friendly. And I think when Colin was asked to get on board and to kind of give him a voice in this film, he popped into a studio in LA without being asked twice and recorded all the audio for this. Mm. And actually, it enhances the film because you do need that sense of, someone who can convey drama, because this is a very dramatic film. It takes us back to the first day. So he's not, it's Simon's contribution's not the only one. There's also family and friends, and most movingly, his wife, Ruth, and the mother of their five kids. So she kind of sets the stage very early on about that she, when she first met him, she thought he was a bit obnoxious, and that he was loud and confident and brash. But they ended up falling in love, and they had, I think, they had two kids, and she was pregnant with their third. When he might have been at Sundance, actually, because he's a very promising filmmaker. He made a couple of shorts, one of which was called The Sound of People. I can't remember the other one, but they made a lot of noise on the international festival circuit, and it was felt he was just a matter of time away from making a very good feature,
Yeah.
And I think he got a floppy foot while he was at Sundance or something, and got it investigated when he came back and was given this absolute bombshell of news that he had motor neuron disease, and which of course causes muscle weakness, paralysis, a loss of mobility and speech, and eventually death, an absolute death sentence, and the cruelest of diseases, really. So he actually has a ventilator now, so he has lived for many years. He was given a ventilator during a medical procedure. But he's no longer able to speak or move. But it's an awful cruelty of that disease, is that you can still feel everything.
Yes.
And the film is really just, in his own words, his absolute determination. At one stage he says, the hardest thing about living with this disease is the distance it puts between me and the people I love. The best thing about it is the living part. So this is a man, despite his failing health, who is absolutely determined, really, to see his kids grow up, and it's really, really moving. Directed by Frankie Fenton. And it's just, there's an awful lot of love in this film, and the whole background behind it, and the people who are involved in the project, I think. And it comes across on screen. I think it's a really, really touching and lovely film. Hard to watch at times, I will say, but
yeah,
very emotional.
And very quickly, the second documentary, again, an Irish documentary, Kevin Roach, The Quiet Architect.
Another little gem, directed by Mark Noonan, who's shown his range here, because he made a little feature film called You're Funny Too from a few years ago. And now he's making a doc about this extraordinary man who designed, a load of buildings in the US, but would be best known here for the Convention Centre.
It's his
work. And yeah, he had me at hello, really, Kevin Roach. In the first scene, you see him going in this kind of outlandish, offended voice at being asked when he was going to retire. He's 95 now, and he says, why would I retire? Why would you retire? To play golf? To talk to your spouse? No, he's not retiring.
He makes a sound point.
He's got a lot of energy, and the film is beautiful. Looks really gorgeous as well. They've got a lot of beautiful footage of these amazing buildings that have won him numerous awards over the years.